This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is Afternoons on Dubai Eye 103.8.
I'm Helen Farmer. On today's episode of Afternoons, we were asking, do you do too much for your kids? Over-parenting could be holding them back. We were speaking to a psychologist and getting your take on this too. We had Dr. Shefali Verma discussing current health crisis. Why is everyone so sick? And offering some insights about fasting in and out of Ramadan. Tom Paulson, sales director of House & House, addressing the recent changes concerning the RERA rental increase and offering a bit of an overview on the topic too. We were speaking to an air and space lawyer offering legal advice on something we've never talked about on the show before. Where does air stop and space begin? And we were looking to the headlines out of the UK regarding egg freezing clinics deliberately misleading women, according to one MP. So what does a UAE fertility expert have to say on the topic? Dr. Shefali Verma is in the studio. She's a general practitioner, but she's also an integrative medicine specialist. So we are talking whole body root cause. We've already had questions about fasting and doing that safely in and out of Ramadan. But I want to know first, Dr. Shefali, in my croakiest voice, why is everyone sick right now? What's going on?
I know everyone's sick. I actually think it is the time for a holiday. I feel like people are just super run down. And I also feel like the pressure seems to be on, you know, whether it be financially, everybody's like, you know, hustling. And I just don't think there's any place for recovery right now. And I think that's just like breaking us up a bit.
I think that I'm going to completely misquote it, but a thing about rest or your body will force you to take a rest.
That's it. Not listening. And so it's telling you what to do.
Yeah. Okay. So this is me. So here's what I wanted to ask you. When you start, let's go back in time to last Thursday. I was like, oh no. And you know when you know, sometimes you do a sneeze, you're like, oh no, that's the start of me getting sick. Or you wake up and you're like, oh no, I'm getting sick.
Or your kids.
Yeah, when the snotty-nosed little ragamuffins come home, you're like, oh, you're bringing the plague over the threshold. What do you do in that moment? What should you do, take, not do? Are we getting out the, you know, the anti-back wipes and we're, you know, are we, you know, mainlining the vitamin C? What do we do?
I mean, look, if my kids, right now, my kids have been away for their first international trip and they were away for a week, I don't think I slept very well because they weren't here. I didn't realize. They've come back and they are coughing and they have got a runny nose. And that's the time where I think, like, right, I need to up my recovery game. This is not the time to, like, be watching Netflix delayed or whatever it is. I think recovery is really important. This is also the time that I'm not going to overtrain. Listen to my body a little bit more.
I like this, doctor, prescribing rest.
Yes. And I think that we don't prescribe it enough, you know. I will up some of my nutrients for sure.
Like what?
Like D. I definitely take high dose D for like 3 days if I know I'm coming down with something.
Interesting.
Because D is actually an antiviral.
Interesting.
So having high dose for a few days actually does help a lot of viruses.
Because I immediately went for the unbuffered vitamin C, which a doctor had said to me previously, if you start to feel a bit rough, her words were, and it always makes me smile, take it to bowel tolerance.
And honestly, that's actually true. So vitamin C is also what I up. And after a certain amount of grams, yes, you might, you know, have to lose these. And I probably would say I do that too. I do increase my vitamin C.
Zinc?
Yep. I definitely take zinc as well. I also take some electrolytes.
Okay, interesting.
I will make sure that if I'm not really hungry or I'm off my food, I would make sure that I maybe even have some protein, maybe some collagen-based protein.
Jen's saying, what about vitamin gummies for kids?
So, I mean, look, if they don't take anything, sure. But, you know, often when you look at these gummies, the first ingredient is what it has the most of. And that often says some element of sugar. So again, I prefer opening maybe something, a capsule, maybe mixing it in with a drink and, you know, having it so that we don't need to. Because ultimately sugar actually worsens bacteria and viruses, right? Things, what do they grow on? Is that the time to really feed them tons of sugar? Maybe not.
Good point. Dr. Shefali Verma with us today. I would love to hear from you. What were your parents' or grandparents' big ideas about getting better quicker? I'm going to be revealing what my grandma Jean used to say and what's become known in our house as the Big Dave method. How does my dad cure anything. If you do have any questions relating to health, about how you're feeling, I'm also curious about, you know, should you be riding out a fever? And we are talking fasting in and out of Ramadan. We are on hand until 3 o'clock. Dr. Shefali Verma.
This content is for informational purposes only and does not intend to substitute professional medical advice, diagnosis or treatment.
What was the go-to remedy in your household growing up if you had a bit of a sniffle or a sneeze? Dr. Shefali Verma is with us to help us sort fact from fiction and give us a bit of a roadmap if we are starting to feel, as you might have detected from my voice, a little on the rough side. Samuel's saying, my mum's remedy, crush dry ginger, bit of cardamom, clove with palm sugar and a bit of ground coffee. Drink it hot has worked wonders for me. Just giving a... Okay, my grandma Jean, she said, feed a cold and starve a fever. Is there any truth in that?
Feed a cold, starve a fever. I mean, that's really interesting. Starve, for me, just isn't the right word. So what are we starving, first of all? In general, not eating, I'm not sure is great in terms of not getting nutrients, not getting calories. We need those kind of things to actually beat the immune system. Mm-hmm. You know, we need protein to beat the immune system. So it's like, would I... But ultimately, it's almost like, okay, well, you know, at that time, I do feel like, you know, maybe not eat food. Maybe they would have the hot soups. Maybe they would have the bone broths. Maybe they would have those things
That's
without really realizing.
That's what I should have had for my lunch. That's what I should have had for my lunch. Big Dave, my dad, I feel like everyone should have a Big Dave in their life. The Big Dave method is have a curry, loads of Vicks on your chest and your back, put on all of the clothes and go to bed and sweat it out.
I mean, I know lots of people who used to say that back in the day. You know what I like about those old methods is that they weren't overcomplicated. And I think sometimes the stress involved with getting sick and doing this and maybe going doing that and doing this and trying to be almost overly complicated is actually part of the problem. So when you're a bit stressed, you're like, okay, you're sick, put on your clothes, get into bed, da-da-da, rest, da-da-da, okay.
But you know what's changed in that time, though? I can basically touch mine, the mobile phone. So even if you are at home.
Yeah, you're not resting.
You're not resting.
No, you're not resting.
You might say to your boss, okay, I'm not going to be in the office today, but if anything urgent comes up, you can get
Let me know. Yeah.
And then you're there, like, you know, checking the emails the whole time. So you're not properly resting.
No, and I honestly think life is really fast. So back in the day, what did you really do for entertainment? Did you read a book?
Mm-hmm.
What did you do? Okay, maybe watch TV. I remember growing up in here where, you know, Dubai Channel 33, you know, there were, you know, a few programs that used to come up, start at 4, you know, it's not like it is now with the YouTube and the Netflix and like constant stimulation. That's the time where you need no stimulation.
And I think that's when you sleep more as well, because you're like, oh my goodness, this TV program is absolute garbage. I'm going to have a little close of my eyes instead. Raj is saying, for cough, mum would give me honey and ginger, block nose, Vicks. Yeah. That's about it. Somehow these don't work now. I don't know. I put some Vicks on last night. It's such a specific...
It opens it, doesn't it?
It's
lovely. But
it
feels good. I have no issues with placebo either. If mentally you feel like it makes you better, does it really matter? I am one of those doctors. A lot of times they're like, oh, but is it scientific? And you know what? It doesn't matter. Do you feel better? If you do, who cares?
Tick. Okay. What about when to bring the antibiotics in? Because you're not going to approve of this, but I'm going to tell you on radio anyway. Friday morning, I woke up sounding worse than this. I went and spent about 400 dirhams in the pharmacy. Like, give me the throat spray. Give me the Jello Revoice. Give me some cough mixture for my kids, which she then promptly vomited, which was great fun. And she was like, if you're not better within 48 hours, you could take these antibiotics. And I was like, okay, I'll wait. What did I do?
You
went
didn't
home.
Wait.
No, of course. I went home and smashed it. Begins with Z. That's all I know.
Azithromycin.
That's the one.
Mm.
I didn't have any diagnosis. And then, yes, I found myself at the hospital with my daughter, who's also rough. And she had a fever. And they were like, okay, she has strep throat. I'll just have a look down your throat, Mrs. Farmer. Yep, you have it too. And then gave her the same antibiotics. So I was like, okay, I didn't completely mess that up.
No, okay, look, you won in this situation.
Mm.
But, I mean, honestly speaking, I do think it's important to know for sure, is it a virus or is it a bacteria? I mean, antibiotics don't get rid of viruses. They're an antibacterial. Now, a lot of the times, you know, if you take them and you're like, yes, it gets better. You take the antibiotics for like 5 days or whatever. a virus maybe in 5 days would have got better too.
Mm-hmm.
Is it really the antibiotics that made you feel better? Now, a lot of antibiotics also have an anti-inflammatory effect. So yes, they can help. But did you need to, what I was taught by our mentors was that an antibiotic is like an atom bomb. Kill everything. Good, bad, ugly. But the good is important for the immune system.
So for anyone, and I'm obviously asking for myself as well, how can you prepare and repair the body if antibiotics are indeed prescribed and necessary?
So I always get people to take a probiotic for number one. Now, an antibiotic kills probiotics, so timing of your probiotics isn't going to be at the same time as you take the antibiotic. So I like people to keep a 2-hour gap minimum, right? So that, you know, we're trying to like make sure these probiotics kind of reach. Sometimes I will get people to take, if they don't want to, because some doctors say don't, and then they obviously listen to that doctor and they come to me later, then I'll give a higher dose probiotic post, you know, antibiotics for a short amount of time and then be on it.
Mm.
I normally do recommend there are certain, you know, powders and things that I use that I end up trying to rebuild the lining. I encourage fibers because they are your prebiotics to the probiotics. They help the probiotics grow and create that environment. I like cod liver oil. You know, our grandmother's cod liver oil.
You are a bit old school, Dr. Shah.
I'm old.
Stop it. Stop it. Dr. Shefali Verman with us today. We have got questions coming in on immunity, about what to take. We've had some questions about fasting, but not for weight loss. And I'd love to hear your old school remedies. What was happening in your household? Did it work or did it not work?
This content is for informational purposes only and does not intend to substitute professional medical advice, diagnosis or treatment.
Dr. Shefali Verma with us today, general practitioner. She's an integrative medicine specialist practicing out of Iraq and very active on social as well in terms of sharing resources. She's got a special interest in sports and performance, management of chronic diseases, gut health and preventative disease. We've been talking about some of the cures imagined or indeed scientific that you heard when you were growing up. Wasim saying, I grew up in a home where raw onion and garlic were eaten to keep immunity high. Any science in that, Dr. Shefali?
Well, like garlic is actually meant to be an anti, you know, viral. I think it's an antibacterial. I definitely know it helps with fungus. I know with like H. pylori, a lot of the capsules that are herbal have garlic in them. And H. pylori is a bacteria that often can cause heartburn. So yeah, there's something to be said about those things.
See, there you go, Wasim. All good. A message here, no name saying, is there any truth in the merits of riding out a fever? So if you get a fever, what's happening in your body?
I mean, it's an element of inflammation, isn't it? You're basically, temperature rides up. Temperature actually looks at trying to kill. It's a focus of inflammation. If you think about red heat, that's inflammation, isn't it? Riding out, it depends on how high it is. Mm. You know, I was told with the children that up until sort of like 38, don't try and give them Calpol or like Panadol and so forth, because the body is trying to do something and we don't need to like stop it from doing it. And then after that, obviously, there's a lot of things that come with that. They feel uncomfortable. You feel awful. Yes, then, you know, why don't we bring down the temperature? But up until a certain point, I think. I don't think the moment it's like a point few degrees after that you should start taking, you know, paracetamol and stuff like that. I think you can, you know, wait a little bit.
If you've got any questions for Dr. Shefali, now is your chance. It is, of course, the holy month of Ramadan. And we've spoken before about fasting in and out of Ramadan. But I wanted to ask you, what happens in our bodies when we fast? Dr. Shefali, can you break it down for us?
Everything actually just takes a break for a second, you know. And often they do say that the immune system starts to start working and then it starts to like, you know, eat away at like the not so good stuff. But it's really taking a break from all the processes, especially if you look at like the digestive process and things like that. In Ramadan, I think, you know, the whole idea also is about, you know, sacrifice, as it were. So it's that timing of like, you know, giving and being able to sacrifice and so on and so forth. In the intermittent fasting or the other like water fast and things like that on the health aspects, totally different. In terms of intermittent fasting, we talked about this, I think, you know, last time I was here, but it's about, you know, eating under a certain sort of time window. It's still about getting the right amount of calories. It's not about skipping meals, as it were. Although a lot of times they do it like that, don't they? They skip a meal and think that that's intermittent fasting. But actually, it's important to break your fast and then eat regularly until you stop eating and then rest and have enough time to sleep so all the digestive processes happen. But in Ramadan, because obviously this is what we're, you know, right now, there's a lot of things that, you know, when you don't have water, you don't have electrolytes, we don't have, you know, we're awake for the long hours that we're fasting. So we're still active and we're utilizing energy and not necessarily fueling. And when it's time to break that fast, we might not be as hungry or the digestive system might not be ready to take on a huge amount of food. So choosing what to eat when, I think, also becomes important. Mm-hmm. And what are the common problems that we see? Things like kidney stones, constipation. And so these things are known to happen far more in times like Ramadan. So it's about avoiding those things.
What about replenishing your body? So safely breaking your fast, replenishing in a way that you, Dr. Shefali, would be like, yeah, that's a smart choice. What would you be doing?
I mean, I would definitely be taking electrolytes when I break my fast because you don't just lose water, you're losing salt, and we're not replenishing that. I would often make sure that I break my fast with electrolytes. I would have enough protein. I would have enough fiber and carbohydrates. And I might not be able to have that all in one go. So I would probably have a lighter meal and kind of like build up to it. At nighttime, though, depending on if I'm someone who will eat and sleep as opposed to wake up at suhoor and then break their fast, would change what I would eat before I go to bed. Because a lot of times you want to be able to sleep. So if it's too heavy, you might not be able to. So maybe that time would be good to have things like a protein shake with the fiber in it and have the good fats and that kind of stuff so that it replenishes you for longer. Whereas if you wake up in the morning to break your fast, you might have, you'll be able to eat mm-hmm. more, you know.
Right. Okay. So it's a delicate balance. It really, really is in terms of making those choices for the right reasons at the right time. We had a few people asking for some clarification.
But also I think it's about yin and yang.
Yes.
So when are you going to be awake? Do things in a yang sort of way. When are you going to sleep? Make sure that you eat so that you're still able to wind down.
Rest and digest.
Correct.
Okay. Dr. Shefali Verman with us.
This content is for informational purposes only and does not intend to substitute professional medical advice, diagnosis or treatment.
Dr. Shefali Verma with us today. She's a general practitioner. She is all about finding that root cause, that whole body approach, which might mean the detailed history that you give her might be a bit bigger than the other doctors, and with good reason too. Talking gut health, chronic diseases, sports performance, everything up for discussion with Dr. Shefali. But today we're having a bit of a deep dive into fasting. Of course, it is the holy month of Ramadan, but outside of Ramadan too. We've had a question here from Chris. He's saying, I want to try intermittent fasting with an eating window of 11 a.m. to about 6 p.m. A few days a week, my workouts are in the evening at 8. Would it be okay to keep my fasting even if I'm working out? I don't really want to make that window any later. What say you, Dr. Chef?
Well, first of all, I would want to know, you know, why are you training so late? Because if you train late, it's harder to wind down. So does that now affect your sleeping? Why do you not want to like extend your window on those days when you're actually utilizing so much more energy? Wouldn't you want to fuel correctly after? And then there's always a worry that, okay, well, if the blood sugar drops too much in the middle of the night, that might affect your sleep quality anyway. So all the gains that you're trying to get with this whole new lifestyle, maybe you're going to actually be like, you know, going against it mm-hmm. through those kind of decisions.
Okay.
And a new eating window of 11 to 6 is 7 hours. That means you're actually fasting, I think, for an extended, if you haven't done intermittent fasting, I'm not sure that 7 hours is your first go is, you know, long enough, really, you okay. know, to get you all the calories that you need.
Some good questions to think about there, Chris. We've only got a minute left, but just want to come back to, we were talking about immunity, and Manny's saying, is it best to take things like vitamin C and zinc consistently or just blast them when you think you're getting sick?
Now, people come to see me, I do test you, right? So I do testing. And then based upon those testing, I will encourage you to actually have the nutrients that you're deficient in. So there's a baseline. When it comes to vitamin C, I think it is something. If you know that people around you are getting sick or you're feeling run down or you have a deadline, I think that's a good time to like be taking them. I think you can on different times where you're feeling things are good, you could take a break from them. And then, yeah, if you're feeling, you know, sick and or you feel that you're definitely, like we talked at the beginning of the show, where you're starting to get symptoms, that sneeze, you just feel you're not right. Then to blast them for a bit, yes, because you don't want to get sick. Then up the immune system. But maybe carry on taking them at a little bit of a lower dose for a little extended period after. Don't just do it for 3 days and then you're fine and then expect everything to be good.
Just to get you through the other side.
Yeah, just get it through the other side and just build a little bit of robust, like, maintenance immunity, as it were.
Dr. Shefali, we've run out of time. Have run out of questions, though. Busy one today. For anyone who wants to find you on social media, obviously find you at IRAC as well. What's the best way of getting in touch?
I mean, definitely contact me on my Instagram, Dr. Shef, or even on my website, drshefali.com, or directly to the clinic.
If you've got any questions or you want that, you can just send me the word doctor. I will send you Dr. Shefali's details. Great resource on there. And yes, you can find it in person too. For anything, I think of it being like our very own doctor house there, getting to the bottom of symptoms and putting all those pieces together. Thank you so, so much.
Thank you for having me.
What should I be eating, drinking, doing tonight to get over this dodgy throat?
All the things that we talked about.
Okay, fine. Done. I'm going to bed. That's the plan. Bone broth in bed.
This content is for informational purposes only and does not intend to substitute professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
We're talking today about learned helplessness and asking, now put your honest hat on, are you doing too much for your child? Okay, so do any of these sound familiar? Your toddler knows how to put her shoes on, but you do it anyway because it's faster. Maybe you run back to school when your forgetful child forgets their homework or their PE kit again. Your teen leaves dirty clothes all over the floor. Instead of getting into another argument, you do it for them because it's easier that way. Pashmi Kaur with us today, a CDA licensed psychologist at Thrive. She works with adults, emerging adults, teens dealing with anxiety and depression. And yes, I want you to be honest and let me know on the text line, do you think you're doing too much for your children? Pashmi, how are you?
I'm good. Thank you, Helen.
I've had a lot of messages, a lot of questions about this. I've also had a lot of people saying, not my kids, but I do too much for my spouse or my parents. Lots of talk about weaponized incompetence on the text line as well, which I don't think we can necessarily accuse our kids of in a conscious way. Maybe. How common do you think it is for us to be doing too much for our kids, or certainly doing things that they are more than capable of doing themselves?
Like you said, out of pure convenience, for a lot of reasons, doing things faster, a lot of times for our own sense of being useful, being needed, being relevant, a lot of times we all do it.
Yeah, I got accused of it last night. So why is it something that parents struggle with? I mean, you mentioned there about feeling needed, about feeling like we've got purpose, we've got value. Why do you feel like it's something that maybe a lot of parents just can't quite get the balance right, Pashmi?
See, there are lots of things that can play in these situations. It's important to understand that there are probably sometimes situations when someone is actually struggling with some specific task, and it's taking more than usual time for those people to keep up with their tasks. At those times, it's easier to do it for them. For example, if someone is struggling with anxiety or depression, anxiety more less, depression is more so, or someone is struggling with ADHD, which is either diagnosed or not. There are lots of things that keeps a person from being very prompt and very on the task all the time. And in those times, it's important to understand what exactly is the reason. Is it me who is finding the reason for fulfillment? That if I do this, I will be more needed or I will be more appreciated in some ways. Or is it because someone is actually struggling with this?
So to bring it back to the children then, why does it matter if we're doing too much for our children?
in a lot of ways, it can impact our self-image as a parent, especially with younger children, how much we are doing for them, how well put together they look, how successful they are in terms of completing their homework or being dressed or bringing everything that is required for the school project. A lot of people take this as a reflection of how good a parent they are.
I know. I was just thinking that about, because it's the hair in our household. It's the hair. I'd be like, okay, quick wheeze teeth hair before we leave the house. And they go, yep, done it. And I'm looking going, you look like a scarecrow. If we turn up to school, they're going to think that you are, you know, like neglected children who don't own a hairbrush. So I'm going right back into the bathroom. Just bite your lip. I know it's going to hurt, but we've got to get out of the house. Bang, 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 bang. Am I doing my kids a disservice by not letting them accept the consequences of going to school looking like scarecrows? And that's what I'm trying to understand is, should, if it is something like forgetting homework or forgetting their swimming kit, should we just let them suffer the consequences of today you get in trouble, today you don't get into the pool, and tough luck?
Yeah, for once in a while, it's okay to let them deal with the consequences. And if it's happening a lot more than usual, then maybe it's time to look into what is going on. Why are they forgetting things? Why are they not doing things as per the kids their age should be doing?
Well, there's a couple of things at play here. One could be poor executive function, which could be something that could be diagnosed for sure. Yeah. Like, obviously, you can't discount that. Otherwise, it's often, and I'm not going to hold back here, it's often kids that are over-parented and maybe even over-nannied in this part of the world who aren't used to having to do stuff for themselves. And that's really doing them a massive disservice in the long run. You know, they're not going to hit those milestones. They're not, you know, if they do go on to further education in the wild world, be able to function as adults. So we're going to be talking next about how to stop doing so much for your children. And we've also had some impassioned voice notes and messages on the topic as well. Dennis saying, do you think it is worse in Dubai because of nannies? We'll ask about that as well. Right now we're asking, do you do too much for your kids? Are you ultimately holding them back with their independence, their milestones, or do you feel like throwing your little once? Let me know your thoughts. Really interesting to get your take on this on 4001 on the app or the WhatsApp. This is Sophie, who's been in touch talking about what happens in their household.
Hi, Helen. Thought I would share some of my views on encouraging your children to be independent and self-sufficient. For me, it's essential. And I think when I listen to all of my friends with similar age children, I have a 6-year-old, an 8-year-old and 10-year-olds, I think I am at an extreme of the spectrum of pushing my children to do way more around the home and for themselves than anybody else I know, including my husband, who gives them a lot more latitude. Why do I do this? Well, I was brought up to be equally independent. I was brought up to believe and understand that adults around me were there to ensure that I was safe, but they weren't there to be my slave or mollycoddle me or let me get away with behaviours that aren't acceptable out in the real world. And it's what I continue to role model to my children, especially here where the norm is that there is somebody in the house to help them. And well, what I say is to help me, that my housekeeper and my helper is there to help me. She's not there to help my children. In fact, my children should be helping her because they're in an age where between them, they've got 6 arms, 6 legs, and at least a couple of pretty functioning brains. And she should be using them as a way to finish her pretty basic workload. So what does that look like? My kids, including my 6-year-old, can all cook basic meals. They can all make cups of tea and breakfast, and they're expected to do that at the weekend and bring it up to me. They make their packed lunches. They sort out their school bags. They walk the dogs. They feed the animals. They clear up after themselves. Clean the kitchen, wipe down surfaces, stack dishwashers, unstack dishwashers, vacuum if they make a mess and drop things on the floor. They have to make sure their rooms are acceptably tidy, make their beds. Sometimes they'll walk the dogs and go to the shops for us. Particularly my older one will go off on his bike to the local community shop, I think it's really important that he learns the value of money, that he interacts with people, that he learns to use change and check what's coming back at him. For me, it's about values. It's about being treated as you want to be treated in the future. It's about learning skills, self-sufficiency, problem-solving, team-building, cooperation, communication, resilience, time management, all of these things. The more I ask my children to do, the more they're learning those.
Sophie, they're talking about her 6, 8 and a 10-year-old. I mean, Sophie, where is the parenting book, I ask you? I think it sounds absolutely amazing. Joining us from Thrive Now, we have got psychologist Pashmi with us today talking about, are we doing too much for our kids? On the text line saying, no name, but my husband accuses me of babying the kids. He would have them ready for bed themselves, take themselves off every night, but they're only 6 and 7. What's wrong with being hands-on when they're little? It's not forever. I think the hands-on thing is, it's a bit different to over-parenting, which is what we're talking about now. So if anyone who's just been listening to Sophie going, yeah, that sounds great, I want my kids to be doing more for themselves, I want them to be equipped with skills that are going to kind of help them in the future, how do you pull back from doing so much for your kids, Pashmi, do you think? And should you say, I'm not going to do that for you anymore, in the nicest possible way?
Yes, I think the key here is having some time at hand so that the kids have some time to understand, question, and execute. Because they are not as fast as we are, we need time for them to execute in their own speed.
And also,
apart from that, a lot of times at Thrive, I've seen the parenting is impacted by people's own experiences. Mm. So that also needs to be considered.
I think the communication thing is really crucial. You know, I am not doing this for you anymore because, you know, you are capable of doing it. I want you to be, you know, an independent contributor to the household and to the world, ultimately. There probably will be some pushback, I would well imagine. I also wanted to put this to you from Dennis, saying, do you think it's worse in Dubai because of nannies? My kids mostly grew up in the UK and definitely got lazier when we moved here and had home help. We've had to have some big chats with both our nanny and the kids about what they're capable of. I think yes, probably, in terms of, but making sure that you as a family, you know, Sophie saying there that her helper is there to make her life easier, not just that of the children, making sure that you as a family, as a household, are all on the same page. What do you think?
I think it's important, like you said, communication is extremely important. When you talk to the kids, and it doesn't have to be a forceful communication, or it doesn't have to be a tough communication. It's just, what would you like to do? What is easy for you? What is difficult for you? Pick out of these things, choose what you like to do, and that's how you empower through the communication.
Let's get a parenting coach's take now. This is Joanne Jewell from Mindful Parenting.
Hi, Helen. Jo Jewell here. Great topic of learned helplessness that you're discussing today. It's something that comes up often in my work with parents, where some parents will have experienced not developing independence in developmentally appropriate way as children, and struggled with their strive towards independence as they got older. And other parents will have felt that they were not fully supported in the way they would have wanted to be as children, and therefore will almost over support or over parent, we sometimes use, children. And so I think it's important to be aware of, you know, how did I feel supported as a child and moving into those teenage adolescent years, and whatever way we choose to support our own children, adolescents, that we do that from a perspective of what is developmentally appropriate, rather than trying to either copy what we had, which may not necessarily be what works for our children in the world we live in today, or we try to do something, you know, almost the opposite. So in the first 5 years of children's lives, they are super keen to be cooperative, to help us. You know, help could be in inverted commas because it doesn't always feel like help. And sometimes as busy parents, we are not always open to this help. And so we, you know, try to get children to go and play when they want to cooperate with us. But it's actually a really lovely age to encourage this cooperation, and to help them to learn those skills at an age where they really want to. They want to be around us and they want to help us. And then, you know, as they move into the older years, we often get really frustrated that they don't cooperate or they don't want to help. And this makes us fearful that we've raised children who are entitled or ungrateful. But actually, in those older, you know, pre-adolescent, adolescent years, that's not really where they are developmentally. They're much more focused on, you know, the wider world and also what's going on in their own individual lives. So I think if we can look at the developmental stages of children's lives, it really helps us as parents to think about what are the skills that my child's brain is really looking to learn in this age, and let me teach them at the age when they're ready to learn it.
Really interesting take from Joanne Jewell there. Thank you so much for raising this as a topic. I think it's given an awful lot of people a lot to think about, including myself, Pashmi. So thank you. Wishing you and the team at Thrive there all the very best. And yes, I think my kid's going to be doing a little bit more this evening. I will maybe talk some about it.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer on Dubai Eye 103.8.
With House and House, 10 years of unlocking opportunities in Dubai real estate.
Always a busy one when House and House are in the studio. We've got Sales Director Tom Paulson with us today, and we're having a little look, or actually an in-depth look, at that RERA rental calculator, because there's been a bit of a reset recently, and I've had a lot of screen grabs sent to me with kind of crying faces. How are you, Tom?
Good, thank you, Helen. Thanks for having me again.
Absolute pleasure. Now, it is always a busy one when we talk about property law, and of course when you come in to talk about what's actually happening kind of on the ground as well. For complete newbies or people who have just kind of heard this RERA phrase knocked around, what is the RERA rental calculator? How is it calculated? What purpose does it serve?
Yeah, so to put it very simply, it's where you take what your current rent is, what the owner is achieving, the tenant is paying, and if you want to increase the rent as an owner, you have to input that figure into the calculator, which is on the RERA website or the REST app, Dubai REST app. And then it takes an average of what your similar type of property is in that specific area. So, for example, if you owned a two-bedroom apartment in the Marina, then it takes an average of all the average rental prices in the Marina. It gives in what's called an index price, and then it sees if you're below that or in line with that to warrant a rent increase.
So recently, and it was just the beginning of this month, there was a RERA rental calculator reset. Mm-hmm. Why? And what brought that about, do you think?
So in short, I think the average price as per the index hadn't been updated for, well, I moved in as a tenant into my old property in the year 2020. Mm-hmm. So three and a half years ago, let's just say. And the average price, I was in a one-bedroom apartment in Dubai Hills Estate. And it said that I was paying 60,000 dirhams.
Nice.
Yeah. And actually, at the time, said the average rent was between 47 to 57,000 for a one-bed in Dubai Hills Estate. So I was paying technically above the market average, but it's because it's the largest layouts. It's the first building in Dubai Hills Estate. So you can naturally get larger layouts, mm-hmm. Seen, I guess, as a premium building. Now, even though I was leaving my property because I bought a place, so I left in 2023 in around October, it still said even then that the average one bed as per the calculator was 47 to 57. Because I looked at my negotiations with the owner, because I wasn't 100% sure if I was leaving, because you have to increase it 90 days at least before the expiry of the contract. And at that stage, I still was undecided if I was renewing or not. And I was then the market rate, which we were renting them for at House and House and across, obviously we look at the Dubai Land Department data, was about 100 to 120,000 for the same apartment. So I was actually 100% behind the market at that point, nearly, but I wasn't entitled to a rent increase as per the calculator.
So what was interesting about 2020 is that we knew people, it was year of the COVID. Mm-hmm. And so we've now seen, as you say, kind of 4 years later, this reset to really reflect what actually is happening out there, what prices are people paying. So how is that going to impact landlords, this reset? Because obviously people want to be in line with market. They want to be getting what their property is worth. And now they can increase within a legal time frame.
Yeah, absolutely. So back to that example of me, let's just say it said the average rent for mine was 47 to 57,000. Now that average has gone up to, for one bed in Dubai Hill Estate, just using that as an example, but it's across the board, this will most likely be for most communities. I haven't looked at every single community, but the majority of them have gone up significantly, the average. It now says it's 81 to 99,000. So that meant if I wanted to renew, I'm effectively more than, well, I would have been entitled to a 20% increase in my rent.
So as you say, yeah, previously it was this 20% maximum jump. Now with this reset, is it kind of all bets are off and landlords can say, well, I don't need to worry about it being a maximum percentage increase. I can just go by what the calculator's saying.
Yeah, no, your landlords are still, the maximum cap is 20%. And that is only if you're 41% behind your current rent you're receiving as a landlord is 41% plus behind what they deem the average to be.
Okay.
You can't as an owner just be like, well, it's just gone up, so I'm going to increase it by 20%. You still have to adhere to the brackets and to the law.
Any questions for Tom Paulson, speaking to a sales director there at House & House, get in touch 4001. You've got the ARN Play app, you've got the WhatsApp too. We're going to talk about timeframes, how does it impact tenants as well, and what does it mean for the overall Dubai rental market?
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer on Dubai Eye 103.8.
With House and House, 10 years of unlocking opportunities in Dubai real estate.
Mr. Popular in the studio today, Tom Paulson is Sales Director at House and House. We've been talking about the RERA rental calculator and the reset that happened early this month, its impact on landlord, about timeframes as tenants as well. Before we go to the text line, I just wanted to ask you, what do you think this means for the rental market overall here in Dubai, Tom?
Well, naturally, I can imagine there'll be some unhappy tenants being told that they've got potentially up to a 20% increase in their rent when before, you know, maybe they were going into it budgeting, they didn't.
Mm-hmm.
However, on the flip side of that is that it has been, if you've been a tenant for the last year or so, it won't affect you too much because the rents have been, you know, quite high in that period anyway. It's with tenants like who've been there for 4 years or circa 4 or 5 years who will see the biggest hit. But then caveat to that is that they have had it pretty good for them years, right?
So easy street for a while.
At some point, it's going to have to reflect the current market conditions because otherwise it will deter investment into the city. And it is the fairest, most, you know, fairest measurement metric possible.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to take accurate figures into consideration.
Well, Fazal Mesh asking some clarification, if you don't mind.
I'll do my best.
Nev saying, please ask if a landlord is allowed to increase the rent after the first year into the contract, or does he have to wait for 2 years? Many thanks.
No, they can increase it after the first.
But time frame, which brings us to our next message.
Yeah.
Here saying, my landlord sent me a rental increase 87 days from the renewal of my contract. He stated he sent me an email in February, but used an incorrect email. He's communicated to me on my correct email before, and my email is correct as per my tenancy contract. I've now received the increase within the 90 days. Am I right in saying he's not allowed to apply any change to my tenancy contract?
Yeah, on the face of what you're saying is that he wouldn't be allowed to, because on your tenancy contract, which is actually on the Dubai Land Department template, which can't be edited, there's the law, is there, that both parties confirm that the contact details used, email address, phone numbers are accurate, and they're the ones that communication should be between. So even if he mistakenly or she mistakenly emailed the wrong email address, and they have emailed, by what you said, the right one before, you have a phone number, it could have been done.
Mm-hmm.
A means of contact. I mean, obviously, we're taking this as face value, as two sides, but on what she's saying is that if it goes, if it lapses past that 90 days into 89 onwards, then no increase is allowed.
Snooze, you lose, landlord or lady. Tom, run out of time, but thank you so much for coming in. I think it's been a real hot topic and it's interesting to think about, yes, those increments, those changes. Can I just ask you very quickly, where have we seen the biggest jump in terms of community in the rental increase?
I think it's just been across the board, to be honest, because the whole market's gone up pretty much, you know, well, in the time that it's was last updated, probably up to 100% in some areas since mm-hmm. then. So it's going to be reflective of all communities.
Do you think we might see a further reset where things might come down?
I don't think so for the time being. I think that, you know, there's a lot of people moving here. The supply is yet to catch up, and I think it will take a long time to. And hopefully the population will keep increasing, because it's a good thing that we must be doing things right here.
Yeah.
We go into a lot more detail about these rent increases, what it means for tenants maybe pushed over the edge to buy here now if their rent does increase. And we are seeing a lot more first-time buyers come to the market because of this. You know, if you're on the cusp and you think, actually, this last increase, I may as well pay my own mortgage than someone else's. Mm-hmm. But yeah, me and Luke, one of the managing directors on our podcast, we have a 30-minute chat about this. So if you do need to get more details on it, then that's coming out in the next 7 days, hopefully.
Perfect. If you want to send me the word house, I'll send you the website so you can find out more about previous podcast episodes and, of course, contact the team if you are looking for a bit of guidance, or indeed you are looking to take the plunge, buy, or indeed sell. As I said, big demand right now. So if you are looking to sell, I'm sure the guys would be very happy to talk you through that process. Tom Paulson, thank you so much.
Thank you, Hannah.
Wonderful week ahead. I know you're probably busy, so...
Yeah.
We'll leave you to it.
Appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Always, as I said, if you send me the word house to 4001, I'll send you the details of that podcast and indeed the team at House & House. Tom Paulson speaking to us, sales director at House & House. We often have doctors in the studio, but it's a doctor of a different kind today. Isadora Casas Valle-Pacheco? Am I saying it right?
Yeah.
Tell me your name properly.
So it's Isidora Jesús Casas del Valle Pacheco.
Oh, my
goodness. So never mind. Everyone calls me Izzy. It's Izzy.
Let's go easy with Izzy. How are you?
Good, and you?
You have got a PhD in space law, dark and quiet skies. You're an unbelievable, an aerospace lawyer. How on earth did you start to identify that this is something that you wanted to do?
Well, I'm in the process now of, I just started my PhD, which is great. But actually, you know how there's some children who always wanted to be an astronaut or obsessed with space? Yeah, that was not me at all. I actually wanted to be a doctor, like a medical doctor, like my father. And I was obsessed with it. But fortunately or unfortunately, however you see it, I got into an accident. I got electrocuted.
Whoa.
So I had to drop out of like dentistry school and, well, what do you do then? Career switch.
You look to the stars, clearly.
Clearly, or Google. I switched to law school and I thought, what are interesting areas of law? And then this air and space law thing came up and I was like, is this real? So I took a trip to Australia and went to a congress, not knowing anyone or anything about it. I fell in love, never looked back.
So what is it exactly that you do? What are some of the common challenges or interesting cases that you can share, that you can, you know, share on the radio, I mean?
So I think as an air and space lawyer, there's a lot to do. There's first this area that it's air law, and then there is space law. And you can be as, quote unquote, a normal lawyer. So just look at contracts or just look at insurance policies.
But
or
back on Earth.
But for space, like instead of for a car, it's a spacecraft. Or if it's liability, it's the same. And for components, for satellites, instead of components for manufacturing for a car or a truck, then it's a satellite. And then you can go into other areas, which is more public international law. So the UN, for example, the UN has a committee of outer space affairs. And actually for 2022 and 2023, the chair, the director was Omran Sharaf, who is an Emirati, he is an engineer. So the UAE is highly involved as well. So there's a lot to do.
You mentioned before air and space. When does air turn into space?
Oh, that's honestly, everyone's kind of debated about it because it's not clear anywhere. But some people take this, what is called the Kármán line, which is where basically if you have an airplane, the airplane would stop flying. It would just fall because it doesn't have enough like air to keep flying. And that is basically between 80 to 100 kilometers from the sea level up to all the way to the sky. So many people say basically 100 kilometers.
Wow. Okay. What are some of the misconceptions, misunderstandings, myths that you're often kind of confronted by about being a space lawyer, Izzy?
Well, first, many people think I'm like Men in Black.
Maybe you are. Maybe it's just a massive double bluff.
Ooh, who knows? Can't say much about it. Or I think some of the misconceptions is that there's not too much field to work in, but you can work from astronomy into aerospace, into satellites, or into so many areas, diplomatic sites. Even Dubai and the DIFC has space courts.
There's a space court in the UAE.
Yes, the DIFC has this courts from the future, which is the blockchain. There is one on new technologies and space.
Every day is a school day. We are in conversation with an air and space lawyer now, Isadora, in the studio. But I want to know a little bit more about protecting dark skies next. You know, are there any legal strategies for combating light pollution? And yeah, some trends, developments in this space as well. Right now, though, it is air and space lawyer Izzy in the studio. She's working on a PhD on dark and quiet skies, space law. Latifa's saying, if you want to choose this as your career, how do you go about it in the UAE? Great question. Is that a possible route here?
Absolutely. So the UAE has done massive advancements at the moment. So the University of Sharjah actually just launched a master's in air and space law. Also, the DIFC courts, the space courts, now have a moot court. So there's a lot of universities that are with teams that want to compete in this moot court, which is kind of like a fake court on a fictitious case. And I'm also in conversations with certain institutions to see if we can have more of these programs.
Can I ask you about your interest then in dark skies? And we were in Oman over the weekend. We stayed on a dhow and I looked up the sky and I was almost tearful, actually, because I actually hadn't seen stars like that in the longest time. And where I'm from in the UK, it's a protected dark skies area. You know, people go there and it's incredible. Can I ask you about the laws around that? You know, are there legal strategies for preserving dark skies, you know, thinking about combating light pollution? What's being done and what would you like to see being done?
Well, there's two kinds of pollutions that come from dark skies. One is from Earth, actually, and that is from the cities. So you have protected areas. I fell in love with dark and quiet skies when I worked for an observatory and I went to observation sites and saw the real night sky. Mm. But then on the other hand, you have other types of disturbances which are in the sky, and those are from satellites. Satellites reflect light, so you can even see them. Sometimes maybe you've seen Starlink, that they look like some pearls flying in the sky. So those, when they go through an astronomical image, it's like a cat went through your image and photobombed the hell out of it. And that is the preservation that I'm dealing with right now. And the same happens with other types of telescopes, that they use radio waves. So there's interference. Those interferences, now there's no international treaties or anything, but we are putting in the agenda for COPUAS, for the Committee of Peaceful Uses of Outer Space, on how to advance with this. And the other, the city legs, is more of a local law rather than space law.
I don't know if you can answer this, and it feels like something that my kids would ask after watching Minions. But we had a question earlier from Shazza saying, who owns the moon?
Oh, there's so many people who ask that question. Also because there was a Chilean lawyer and poet that tried to inscribe the moon under their name. I'm Chilean. I'm from South America. So I always get this question. No one owns the moon. Not because the United States planted a flag with Neil Armstrong. It means that actually they own it. There's different theories about that, but basically it's under the idea that it's under global commons. Mm-hmm. Like you wouldn't own it as you don't own or the atmospheres or the high seas.
We are seeing more and more people going to space, and some of that is through, you know, obviously governmental space programs, and we're seeing more space tourism. You know, what about things like, you know, property damage, accidents, harm to celestial bodies? Is this all stuff that's being worked on behind the scenes? Is it that, you know, that some of these conversations that we as, you know, mere mortals here on Earth would have no idea are going on?
Absolutely. As you say, with space tourism, now it's not the classic astronauts that one would think that would train for ages to be there. You can actually just pay to go. And the tickets are not even that crazy expensive.
Really? How expensive?
One is $250,000. That for a government, if you want to send someone from, it's not the $55 million that we're talking about to go to the International Space Station. So as it becomes, quote unquote, more affordable, and it will become with time, you'll have more people. So, of course, all of these topics are being discussed because we went from having basically three countries going to space to new actors in space and people who want to put, like Axiom, they want to put hotels in space.
What kind of conversations do you think we'll be having in 10 years' time about who or what is up in space? I mean, this feels like a really fast-moving decade in that area.
It is a fast-moving decade, but space still takes some time. Like some Elon Musk has plans to have people on Mars by 2030. It's very ambitious, but I think it's good to have ambitious timelines. I mean, you'll always fall a little bit short of that. You'll go longer. But in 10 years, I do think space resources is going to be a big topic. Because there's no real international treaty dealing with that. Beyond owning the moon, for example, who owns the stones that you get from the moon, the minerals.
Jem wants to know, would you go to space?
Absolutely. I would definitely. My husband always says that I'm crazy, but I would absolutely go to space if I had the chance.
I just feel like you've moved and chosen an area that is just going to get more and more exciting. What are you most excited about?
I think in this area, I would like to see if we become interplanetary species. Because now, if you think about it, Mars, actually, it's a planet that is solely populated by robots, which we put there. It's only robots living on Mars. Actually, the UAE is one of the few countries that have successfully put a satellite in Mars. So kudos to that. And I think I'm excited to see if we'll have people like the Martian, like the movie, actually living on Mars.
Lastly, given the work that you do, the conversations you're having, the people you're meeting, are there any films, resources, TV that you think are particularly true to life or that you really enjoy?
Honestly, I think the one that has inspired the most all of the engineers, because engineers are the kind of people that see something science fiction and they're like, I can build that.
Sure, why not?
Exactly.
Let's reverse engineer that.
Exactly. And that is Star Trek. Star Trek is one of the pop cultures that really inspired so many people, including from Elon Musk to Jeff Bezos and to many of like brilliant space minds. I personally prefer Star Wars, but I know Star Trek is an icon. It's iconic.
Thank you so much for coming in and kind of lifting the lid on, I mean, a career I didn't even know existed, never mind, was right here in the UAE. Good luck in your PhD. It's great to have you here and to be able to call on you for some really interesting topics that we know are going to be unfolding over the next few months and years. So, Izzy, thank you so, so much.
Absolutely.
If anyone wants to follow you, find out more, your LinkedIn, your Instagram, am I okay to share those?
Of course. My Instagram is Izzy, I-S-I, space.
Perfect.
No one can write my last name, so I'm easy space.
Thank you so, so much. If you want that, you can just send me the word space and I will share that. Really, really appreciate it. We're talking fertility now. One UK MP has spoken out and said that she believes egg freezing clinics are deliberately misleading women. Well, it got me thinking, what are the laws here in the UAE and what would a fertility nurse specialist, midwife, and yes, someone who's been through multiple egg collections have to say about that too? Ruth O'Dwyer is with us today, medical sonographer, an IVF mum, and recently launched Unfolding Fertility. It's a platform that's really committed to providing education, evidence-based information on all aspects of fertility and IVF. So Ruth, welcome to the studio. How are you?
I'm good, Helen. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I'm so grateful for your various perspectives. As I said, you've had egg collections yourself. You're now a mum of two. You've worked in clinics. You've been through the processes in Europe and here in the UAE. So when these things hit the headlines, I feel like there can be this idea of being quite sensationalist, and you need to think about the perspective of the person that's saying that. What are they ultimately looking to achieve by saying that? But also the implications it has on someone who might be considering these decisions themselves. So before we get into that, I wanted to ask about why someone might consider egg freezing. You know, who can be a good candidate? What do we need to know there, Ruth?
So there's many reasons why women might consider egg freezing. A dominant reason is someone who might not necessarily have found the right life partner yet. Career goals, career aspirations, financial considerations. Then there's also people for medical reasons, cancer treatments, chronic medical conditions like things like endometriosis, maybe women with diminished ovarian reserve. So there's a multitude of reasons why people might consider egg freezing.
What are some of the big myths or misconceptions? Now you've got the microphone that you think, do you know what? I'd like to say that this is just incorrect, or it's far more complicated than people might realise because of. Tell us.
Something I get asked quite a lot is, if I freeze my eggs, does that mean that I am depleting my egg supply? And that is not the case, because we're born with all the eggs that we will have. And by the time we're kind of around 18, 20, we have about 200,000 eggs, and they're all lie immature and they're sleeping. And each month, during our menstrual cycle, those follicles, some follicles are recruited, like antral follicles, and all of those follicles then, under hormonal influence, we will produce one dominant follicle and ovulate. Through egg freezing or through IVF, all those eggs that are there, that cohort is not lost. So basically, you're not actually losing eggs are depleting a supply, because the ones that aren't, that we don't ovulate, or the ones that aren't recruited, essentially would just regress and die off anyway. So I think that's a key thing that people don't actually realise.
That's interesting. And also, I've spoken with friends who've had IVF about this as well, that they were kind of sold this idea of, if you have IVF, you're basically guaranteed a baby. And there are so many contributing factors to why that might not be the case. And age does play a really big role in that, male and female age, you know, both partners. With egg freezing, can this be the perception of, if you freeze your eggs, you are basically guaranteed a baby?
Yes, okay. And the simple answer to that is there's no guarantee. So egg freezing is, you know, it's not an insurance policy that's guaranteed to pay out. But yes, it does give you a sense of empowerment and sense of control, because you can, you know, take, you'll have autonomy over kind of your reproductive health, and essentially you can increase the length of your reproductive lifespan as such. So it's definitely a good option for everybody to consider.
Here's a question. As a mum of girls, for their 18th birthday, should I be getting them some egg freezing?
It's funny, because I worked closely with a fertility specialist in Dublin who had two teenage girls, and who actively spoke about encouraging conversations around freezing eggs from early on. So it definitely increases chances, and it's definitely something that I would kind of speak openly about and have honest conversations about, yes.
So what did you make of this article then, talking about, you know, egg freezing doesn't work, Miriam Kate saying it's a false promise and that women are being exploited? How did it make you feel, and how truthful do you think it is?
I think they're quite bold statements to make from someone who isn't necessarily qualified to kind of speak on the subject. And also, from what I understand, she's a mom of three, and I think she had her first baby when she was 25. So she's probably not coming from the perspective of somebody who is, you know, in the fertility world and the fertility trenches as such. So, and I think as women, we need to be able to kind of elevate women and support women. And statements like that just really aren't helpful. If anything, even the language used was quite kind of scaremongering, which...
We don't need that negativity.
No, we don't.
Ruth O'Dry with us today. Up next, we are going to be talking about ideal candidates and the process as well. In the studio, we've got Ruth O'Dwyer. She's recently launched Unfolding Fertility. It's a platform that educates, empowers, helps you advocate for your own fertility journey. She's a fertility nurse specialist, a midwife, and an IVF mum herself. And we're talking about egg freezing today. And I wanted to ask you, because we've had a couple of questions on this, Ruth, about the what happens. So I guess, how many eggs are extracted? And also maybe a little bit about the process, if you wouldn't mind unpacking that. Would you mind?
Yeah, sure, of course. So it's really important to be as informed as you can be going into the process. So based on your age, on your test results, it's important to have honest conversations with your doctor about how many eggs you need to give you a realistic statistic that you're happy with, a realistic number of a live birth. So for some, that could be 70%. For some, that could be 90%. The research has shown that if you are 38 or younger, you need to get approximately 20 eggs to give you a 70% chance of a live birth. But we need to remember that they are just statistics. Mm-hmm. So it's really important to remember that no number is a guarantee. The process that's involved with egg collection, it's the first step in an IVF process. I think a lot of people forget that. So it involves taking hormonal injections, medications, to recruit that whole cohort of eggs that is available for this cycle, and ensure that we get all of the eggs, they're all mature, and then we collect them. The egg collection procedure itself is, depending on the policy of your fertility clinic, it can be done under local anaesthetic or general anaesthetic. It's a minimally invasive procedure. It takes approximately 20 minutes. And then those eggs are frozen in a process called vitrification, or the mature eggs are frozen. But again, with that, with the process, it's very important to remember that numbers can drop at every junction as well. So that's something that people aren't really aware of. The numbers game, it's very much a numbers game, and something we need to be really aware of.
This is why I think the platform, and I guess the service, the expertise that you're offering is so, so valuable to so many people, because you get confronted with numbers, you get test results, you have uncertainties, you have questions, you haven't got that much time necessarily face to face. And I think you're providing this kind of missing jigsaw puzzle piece in helping people feel comfortable and confident. For anyone that wants to find out more, what's the best way of getting in touch with you, Ruth?
So my Instagram handle at the moment, Unfolding Fertility, working on my website. So watch this space.
Tell you what, if you want to send me the word health, I will send you the Instagram so you can contact Ruth there. And as I said, keep up to date on the website as well. Thank you so much for coming in. We've got lots to talk about. We'd love to have you on the show again and help as many people as possible.
Thank you so much for having me, Helen. Thank
you. Absolute pleasure. Ruth speaking to us there. We'll be looking at egg freezing. Unfolding Fertility is her platform. And thank you for downloading this episode of the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. Don't forget, you can subscribe. You'll get direct to your phone as soon as it's out. And you can listen to me live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Monday to Friday between 2 and 5 p.m.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.